I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, I'll take you to the Gulf Coast to see how the oil spill is affecting fishermen. Where to watch the game in L.A., I've got a list of the best sports bars in town. Jonathan Gold is here with a restaurant for us to try. Pine Nut Mouth. What is it and how you get it? And how to pair cheese with sake. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery to see what's in season at the farmer's market this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Seasonality is such a big part of our excitement down here at the farmer's market. We've got cherries in now. We've got some late winter vegetables, some early spring vegetables. It takes a chef to help us really negotiate what's really happening at the market. And right now I'm talking with Joan Vogel. She has a self-published book that talks about wonderful recipes that are market-inspired. And Joan, today, perhaps you could help us out with what we could make that's inspiring and in season right now at the farmer's market.
Well, what would be fun to do is take some of the things that you wouldn't think would go together. I'm making a purple cabbage, green bean, orange salsa slaw, and it goes with everything you've ever put aside of coleslaw. So we're going to shred the purple cabbage, cook the green beans 3 minutes so they're nice and crispy, and toss those in. And then we're going to make a really unusual citrus salsa, which uses oranges, sweet onion, basil, and dried fresh fruits, and chop them all up to give it a little bit of sweetness, and throw all that together because there's sweetness and tartness, and just make a nice simple vinaigrette to go with this salsa, and put a little orange juice or a little marmalade in that vinaigrette as a little secret ingredient, and you're going to have a wonderful slaw that nobody's ever seen before.
Why do you pick the purple cabbage as opposed to the green or the mixed purple and green?
You can do the mixed purple and green, okay. But what's really important is purple is a gorgeous color, and it wakes up the palate, and it wakes up the plate.
What is your technique for getting your cabbage as thin? And you're talking thin, thin, thin slices. No chunks, no slabs, thin slices.
Yes. I take actually one of those graters, one of those square
box grater,
uh-huh. Put it on the counter, quarter your cabbage, take the heart out, and just go.
Okay. From the core out or from the outside in?
Well, you've got two naked sides.
Oh, on the flat side. Okay.
Yeah, on the flat side, and just get that core out and then just keep going and stop when you get close to those fingers.
Right.
I'll tell you, I have another tip. I use scissors to cut up a lot of my vegetables. I always cut my basil with the scissors. And if you have leftover cabbage, you can take a scissors and cut it up.
Taking the tips off your green beans. Do you do that too?
Yeah, but
scissors?
Yes. Yeah. You line them, you take them like a bunch of flowers and you just snip all the ends.
Okay.
And then you line them up on the other side on the counter, like a deck of cards.
Right.
And you just cut the ends off and you're there.
Now you're cutting these in 1-inch pieces or you're leaving them long for your slaw?
Well, 1 inch is a little too small.
Okay.
I like to have a little bit of difference with everything. So I think 1.5 inch, I would cut them in half.
Well, that's inspiring, and it's great to think, now here come these green beans. What am I going to do that's different? I'm so glad we got this great new coleslaw recipe to try out. Sounds fabulous, and thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was Joan Vogel. She's the shopping cart chef. She wrote a scandalous cookbook called 69 Quickies in the Kitchen that you can get at many local stores and on Amazon. And it's delightful having her at the market sharing her inspiration. We love it when young training chefs come to the market as well as our wonderful professional chefs. And today we have Daryl Smith's culinary arts class from Beverly Hills High School. 85 students are here today at the market exploring and learning and tasting new things. And to help us teach them, we have Neil, who's one of the guys who works over at Weiser Family Farm. And today we got a special produce item, Neil. And why don't you talk about it? It's purple sprouting broccoli.
Correct. Purple sprouting broccoli is an English broccoli. I believe it's an heirloom, so it's been around for a long time. It takes about 11 months to grow. Normally, broccoli is somewhere around 60 to 90 days. This is a long time for any produce to grow, is the 11 months. It has a lovely deep flavor. As you can see, it's kind of a purple heads on it. With this, you can eat all of it. You can eat the leaves, the stems, the tops, everything. It has a really deep, intense flavor. Best to be sautéed quickly to keep the integrity of it. So sautéing it with a little olive oil, some salt, garlic perhaps. could be steamed. Again, I would probably steam it just for a moment. You want to do it al dente, so it's nice and firm. Other than that, that's pretty much it.
And you want to keep that bright flavor. And now this is not a big broccoli head with little side shoots. This is a long, slender stalk of broccoli leaf and top. But it never gets a big crown. It's a little floret kind of a head, very delicate, very flowery almost.
And it actually does flower. There's yellow flowers that flower from it once it, you know, past eating time.
You say it takes 11 months to grow. Right. You're harvesting now. How long will it be until it just bolts and turns into flowers?
My guess is probably another 2 or 3 more weeks left. We've had it now for about a month, so the window is about a 6-week window. And as I say, it takes a long time, so we'll be planting very shortly for this time next year.
For next year. Yeah. And Wiser Family Farms, is it lots of markets? You go to about, how many markets can we find you?
I think there's probably about 15 markets now, everything from Long Beach to Hollywood, Beverly Hills, all the Santa Monica markets in Venice.
All right, Neil, and this stuff is just, and you can, of course, chomp on it raw.
Raw is probably at its best, but if you're serving it on a dish, you'll probably want to do it just hot and quick. That's the key.
All right, Neil, well, thank you so much.
Welcome.
It looks beautiful.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was Neil from Wiser Family Farms, and he's telling us about this wonderful purple sprouting broccoli that takes 11 months to get to the table. Unbelievable. Thank you. For the Market Report.
Thank you.
This is Laura Avery.
Thank you.
Pictures and recipes from the Market Report are at kcrw.com/goodfood. There are few things worse than being betrayed by a bite of food. Polly Campbell was betrayed by a pine nut. She's a food writer for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and she has firsthand experience with pine nut mouth.
What happened was 2 days after Christmas, I woke up with sort of a bitter taste in my mouth. Nothing really got rid of it, you know, brushing my teeth, rinsing, whatever. It still was there. And then when I started eating that day, everything I ate tasted bitter, just terribly, terribly bitter. And nothing worked. It was awful. I kept trying to eat different things to see if it would, you know, help. But nothing did. And I, after, you know, Googling, which one does when one has a strange symptom of something, I saw that other people had been affected like this by pine nuts. And I thought, aha, that's it. We'd had a salad on Christmas Day, which was just covered with pine nuts.
Now, how long did this sort of strange mouth taste last?
Like a week.
Wow. I mean, that would be really scary. I mean,
well,
it was.
You know, it was funny because I'd had these dizzy spells that were turned out to be completely unrelated, but of course I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I've got something awful wrong with me that's creating these weird symptoms. And I happened to go to the doctor for that, and she'd never heard of it. My dentist had never heard of it. And I'm a food critic. I eat for a living. And I thought, well, I guess I can't lose my taste buds. So fortunately, I was on vacation that week.
Wow. So once you started doing some research, what did you discover?
Well, I would say that nobody really knows. There's just on the internet, there's all kinds of speculation. Is it an allergy? It doesn't really seem like you should call it an allergy exactly. You know, it's not like eating a peanut and not being able to breathe or wheezing or something like that. Some people think maybe the pine nuts are rancid.
But what you're describing isn't a rancid taste.
No,
it's a metallic taste, right?
Well, yeah, it's more like a bitter, you could say metallic and bitter taste. And the pine nuts themselves tasted fine.
Now, I've noticed in the last couple of years that the long, beautiful pine nuts that we used to be able to get without too much difficulty from Italy have been superseded by a more short, stubby kind of nut that's coming from China.
Yeah. Well, the pine nuts that I had were labeled as being from either, I think, Korea, Russia, or...
Korea, Russia, or Vietnam?
Vietnam, that's it, right. Yeah.
And they were from Trader Joe's?
They were.
Wow.
And I've had them before. I mean, I have bought pine nuts from Trader Joe's before.
So what is the theory? There must be internet theories.
There are. There's lots of them. I think besides the idea that it's an allergy or that they're rancid, there's just which sounds most reasonable to me is that there's simply more kinds of pine nuts being put on the market in response to the demand for pine nuts. And so they're using new, different species of trees. There's 100 to 150 species of pine trees, many of which have edible nuts. And so I don't know, but it seems more like a food sensitivity to something that we haven't come across before.
Well, because it's sort of like asparagus, where some people eat the asparagus and they experience no after smell, let's say.
Right. Yeah.
And some people do. And that's the same with this pine nut thing. Like every person who ate that salad with you on Christmas didn't experience the same thing, did
they? That's right. I was the only one.
Wow.
Yeah.
Would you ever eat another pine nut?
I've really kind of sworn off them, which is too bad. And, you know, they're in a lot more things. I was just writing about a Pillsbury Bake Off finalist from who's from here, and she has a recipe that uses pine nuts. You know, they use them in Korean cuisine and everywhere, and pesto, of course, is everywhere. So I think I am just going to try to steer clear of them until they find out exactly what it is.
Would you be more willing to try the long European variety?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, from what I read, that seems likely that those are probably better. It's weird, though, because you can't tell. You can't eat one and see if it's going to affect you. You have to wait 2 days. So I think until I get a really good answer, I'm going to swear off of them.
As the week went on, did it start to fade, or was it the same until it disappeared?
No, it faded. It faded over a few days.
Wow.
You know what the worst thing was drinking red wine. And so it felt like all of those wonderful different flavors that you get from a good full red wine, like every single one of those little flavors was reacting in my mouth with this and turning into terrible, horrible flavors. It was really awful.
Read about pine nut mouth at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you've experienced it or anything like it, tell us about it. Leave a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up next, we'll hear about the seafood situation in the Gulf Coast, how the devastating oil spill is affecting fish, and the industry that depends on it. That's next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. On April 20th, an oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. Since then, oil's been spilling into the water, wreaking havoc on wildlife and sea life on the Gulf Coast. As workers rush to try and stop the flow of oil into the Gulf, many fishermen are racing to catch as much fish as possible. I'm joined now by Rusty Godet, a fisheries agent with LSU's Agricultural Center.
We are not sure right now where landfall will ultimately happen, and we're not sure what that landfall will bring in the way of impact.
You know, a lot of people are focusing on talking about the edible seafood, but I understand that it all begins with the microorganisms in the marsh grasses, and that's what a lot of you guys are most concerned with.
Well, the nutrient flow out of the marshes is what actually feeds the zooplankton and the phytoplankton, and this is the basis of the food chain that feeds everything up on top of it, and ultimately it comes up to, you know, primary carnivores like ourselves. Anything that would impact the estuary system and the nutrient flow from that nutrient system will necessarily impact the end product, which would be the fishery products.
Where do you see the oil flowing right now?
As we speak, the oil is kind of holding steady out in the Gulf, the nearshore current that runs along Louisiana and the northern rim of the Gulf of Mexico runs from a easterly to a westerly direction. And so it's the general trend right now is to the west, because the currents and the wind currents, the ocean currents and the wind currents are working together and pushing it in one direction. The wind currents have been working in opposition to the ocean currents, so that's where things start pushing it back towards the east, and that's where we get this oscillation in direction, in trajectories.
As it moves to the west, what fisheries will be most affected?
It depends upon if the oil stays offshore or if it actually enters into some of the estuary systems.
Do you think that there's a possibility that it won't enter the systems?
There is a possibility, yes, because of the currents and the winds. They act sometimes in conjunction with each other, and sometimes they are in opposition to each other. So ever since this spill started, there have been moments of both situations, opposition and conjunction. The species that will be affected it depends upon whether or not it makes landfall to the interior, or if it stays offshore the way it is right now, or if it makes landfall only on the southernmost shoreline.
So let's assume for a minute the best outcome, which would be that it doesn't enter and it just stays offshore. What are the species that will be most affected with it hanging out there?
Well, we have a lot of spawning going on right now. It's a spawning season for a lot, not only the finfish, but the crustaceans and a lot of the invertebrates. And I don't mean to be ambiguous, but the condition that the oil actually reaches those locations, whether it is in the dispersed and treated form or if it's in the raw crude form, the initial form, I don't want to say crude, just the initial form that the contaminant actually reached the surface. So those two things are different contaminants. One is a treated contaminant. The other one is a aged contaminant.
And does it make a difference in the health of the species, or are both equally catastrophic?
Well, I mean, both of them are not desirable, but we're in a matter of triage now, and we're trying to pursue some remediation paths that minimize the potential impact to the environment, to the spawning organisms, and to the older organisms also.
So from a point of view of monitoring, what's happening out there now on a daily basis?
Well, we have a whole flotilla. We've got an armada out there of scientific vessels that are actually taking samples in the water column and on the surface, looking also on the shoreline, wherever they have those isolated incidents of landfall that have thus far occurred, they're taking samples of those also. And then those are being shipped to respective laboratories, LSU being one of them, and they're looking at the initial components as they were there and the toxicity of those components. Based on what we see and what we project is the trajectory of the oil slicks in the machines, you know, that's where the closures to fishery harvest is being enacted. The seafood that's coming out of Louisiana that is in the market and is going into the market is perfectly safe, just as it was pre-spill.
Do you think people really have faith in that?
I do. I have complete faith in it because I know how tight it is. And we have our state and federal people, the enforcement division, is rigorously enforcing those closures. And so no product is reaching the retail or the wholesale product stream that has even a remote chance of being contaminated. The western part of the state and the interior surface waters of the state are still deemed clean and harvestable.
Thank you so much, Rusty. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
I hate to be so ambiguous about it, but it's, the bottom line is that we just don't know at this point in time.
I'm joined now by Captain Lance Nacio, a multi-generational shrimper from Terrebonne Parish in Louisiana. Hi, Captain Lance.
Hi.
So give us an update. What's happening out there? You're on your boat now, right?
Right. We're contracted through BP, and right now we're outfitting the boat to go out when the weather calms off. We're going to be involved in the control burns is what we're going to be doing.
So you're not shrimping now?
No, our area has been closed. They have a partial opening in our area, but we're not shrimping at the time.
Before it closed, were you shrimping at a fierce level, trying to get as much stuff as you could?
We went and tried, but, you know, with the late winter we had, our crops were going to be a little late this year, and they gave us an early opening, which kind of hampered what we'd normally do in the month of May. And they gave us an early opening. It stayed open for 5 days, and they closed it again. And then they reopened a portion of it just a couple of days ago again. But the oil spill is, you know, it's creating havoc throughout the whole state.
So did I hear you correctly saying that now you're contracted to work for BP?
Yeah, that's what we're doing right now. We have the boat in Venice, and we are getting it ready to go out when the weather permits, and we're going to be involved in the control burns that they're doing at the site.
So what does that mean you're going to be doing?
We're going to be pulling these fire booms and collecting the oil, and they're going to burn. They're doing that as part of the cleanup. They're trying to burn a lot of the oil before it makes it ashore.
Are all of the shrimperies affected? Are all of the shrimp fisheries affected right now?
No, they have still probably about half of the state, maybe a little more than half of the state that's not being affected just yet. But the oil is moving westward, and it did move into the areas that we normally fish in the Terrebonne Basin. The past 3 days, I would say they had oil that moved near shore and inshore in some places.
Do you find it kind of ironic that you're not able to shrimp, but you're getting paid now from the people that created this mess?
Well, you know, the way I look at it is that we want to try and save our industry. And right now, the only thing we can do to save our industry is try and help, you know, eradicate this disaster and do our part as far as trying to clean this up.
Okay, thank you so much, Captain.
All righty, thank you.
There's no doubt that seafood is a way of life in the Gulf Coast. We just heard how fishermen are reacting to the oil spill, but what about consumers? Chef C.J. Gertis owns Casamentos, a restaurant in New Orleans. We've heard that there's been this sort of frantic rush to consume mass quantities of seafood. Are you seeing that at your place?
Very much so.
Describe what an average night this time of year used to be like compared to what it is now.
Well, see, we close in the summer. We shut down in the summer all the time. And usually the 2 weeks after Jazz Fest, Jazz Fest is usually two of our busiest weeks of, you know, out the whole year. And usually the 2 weeks after that, in between us closing and Jazz Fest, is usually two of the slowest weeks we have. But these 2 weeks here have rivaled Jazz Fest weeks.
For those of us who haven't been lucky enough to come down and eat at Casamentos, tell us what you serve.
Raw and fried oysters, soft shell crabs, you know, speckled trout, freshwater catfish, shrimp, seafood gumbo, oyster stew. Those are the main ones.
So have you had any problem getting your product in for the last couple of weeks?
Not yet, but, you know, every day that goes by, they're closing more oyster beds. They just closed two more oyster beds yesterday, which makes about 70% of all oyster beds right off our coast are closed. And we also saw a price increase already with oysters middle of last week. You know, they went up a couple of dollars a sack and $4 or $5 a gallon.
Are you nervous at all about what you're going to come back to in the fall?
Yeah, very nervous. You know, I'm 52 years old. I've been in this business ever since basically I was born, you know, into the restaurant. You know, we've had our problems with, you know, certain sections of oysters, you know, when they had the neurovirus. Matter of fact, we just finished with that neurovirus about a month and a half ago, where they closed a couple of sections. But it's always been, if they close a section, there's other sections to go to. Even if they, back in the 80s when they had the red tide, you could still go off of Texas and get oysters, or you could go off of Alabama and get oysters. You know, it just, everybody was helping everybody. But something like this, if they don't get this thing capped, if they don't stop that oil leaking, you know, you're talking about the whole Gulf. You know, everywhere in the Gulf's going to be, you won't have anything. And that worries me.
Since seafood is such an intrinsic part of the culture down there, how important is it to just maintaining the way you guys sort of live your lives every day?
That is, it's gonna change. I, like I said, if something don't happen, it's gonna change. You know, we will still be able to get trout and shrimp and stuff like that. The problem is gonna be. Matter of fact, I was talking to my oyster supplier a couple of days ago, and matter of fact, he was on TV here, and he was saying that if we have to go to the West Coast or the East Coast to get oysters, you're talking about triple in price. And just like a lot of the other oyster restaurants around, he said, you know, we just won't handle them. We won't handle them until, you know, things get straight in the Gulf, which it's a wait and see, you know, and that's the hard part. It's a wait and see because you don't know what's going to happen.
How much does a half dozen oysters cost at Casamento's?
Well, everybody goes really bad. A dozen raw here is $9. They'll run anywhere between 8 and 10, 11, 12. But, you know, that's high end. We're right in the middle. We're $9 a dozen.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. Thank you, CJ.
You're welcome.
I've got links to the most up-to-date information on the situation in the Gulf Coast at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I'll be back in 1 minute here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Put a witty blogger who's also a pastry chef in Paris for 7 years, and you get David Leibovitz. His stories are always entertaining as he navigates the foodways of the City of Lights.
French people are very into singular flavors, and they're not into things that are that take your mouth in a very, very bold direction. Like, they don't like spicy food. They don't like to be knocked down by eating something. So it's actually taught me to be much simpler. And that's actually something that I learned a lot at Chez Panisse as well when I worked there. Because Alice Waters, you know, her idea of a perfect dessert is a scoop of tangerine sherbet. And that's very French as well, just to have something like a gesture after a meal, not a giant, you know, fancy pastry. People come to Paris and they see all the pastry shops and they see the tarts and stuff, but, you know, that's not something people would eat every day. you know, when they find out you're a pastry chef, you're gold in France. They love pastries. They're like, oh, la, la. In America, you say, I'm a pastry chef. And they're like, oh, I can't eat any of that because I'm not allowed to eat this. And, you know, I don't like this and I'm allergic to this. And in France, everyone's like, oh, la, la, j'adore le chocolat. So it's, you know, that you get, when people get something, they're like, wow, this is really good. They're very into eating, which is great.
And you talk about how cookies are sort of a more American kind of phenomenon, the way we eat cookies and the types and breadth of the cookies we eat are very different from things you find in France.
Well, the French don't snack like we do in America, although that's changing. And if you go to the supermarket, you know, there's a whole aisle of snacks and cookies and things. But it's still not the same philosophy. And they also don't bake like we do. You know, in America, you can buy a 5 or 10 pound sack of flour, but in France, you know, they're all 1 kilo, which is about 2 pounds, because they have so many bakeries, people don't have the kitchens like we do in America as well. You know, and people do bake here, it's just not in the same quantity as we do in America. And there are cookies here. You know, the cookies you can get macaron, you can get sablé, which are shortbread cookies. But in general, it's not, you know, they don't have the cookie culture like America. Although I'm working to fix that.
Yeah, I think you're doing a good job, actually. Could you relate, since it's spring and rhubarb is all around us now here at the farmers markets, could you relate your head note story about rhubarb and the French ladies?
Oh, the peeling?
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because when I go to the market, they're not, for one thing, they're not used to Americans knowing anything about food. They think we all eat at McDonald's. And the other thing is you don't argue with French women, it's hard to argue with the French people because, you know, if they realize they're losing, they say something totally illogical and you can't argue back and you're just like, okay, they won. So when I was buying, when I was at the vegetable stand, the woman was explaining to the vendor, you know, you must peel the rhubarb, you must peel the outsides off. And I'm like, okay, I had to speak up because it was an injustice. I said, I've never done that. And now the women are like, oh, but you must. It's très important. Da, da, da. I'm like, okay, look, I was a pastry chef for a long time, and I have never, ever peeled rhubarb. So I bought rhubarb, I took it home, and I made some jam, and I brought some over there, and they were like, oh.
I love it. I feel like half your life is about having the last word culinarily.
Well, you know, France is all about arguments, and it's all about winning an argument.
Are you still totally in love with chocolate? Do you still get excited when a new chocolatier opens?
I do. I'm actually what it really excites me is the people who do bean to bar chocolate. That's become, it's become very popular in America. So I'm still very in touch with the people who make the chocolate in America, and they do send me samples to try of new chocolates, which is really exciting. I think that's one of the things in America that I do miss quite a bit.
David Leibovitz's new book is Ready for Dessert, and I really encourage you to follow him on Twitter. His tweets are hilarious. I also follow Jonathan Gold on Twitter. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here on Good Food every week. Where are we going today, Jonathan?
Thai Town.
And what are we going to find when we get to Thai Town?
We are cruising for boat noodles.
Mm. Now, for some people who have never had them, describe what boat noodles are.
Boat noodles are noodles that were at one time and still are sold from boats on the canals in the Chao Phraya in Bangkok. And it's a very spicy, funky soup that can have almost anything thrown into it and usually does.
So where are we going specifically for these boat noodles?
The default boat noodle destination in Thai Town for a while has been Sap Coffee Shop, which just has a great version. The version today we're going to talk about is at Pa Ord, which is a fairly new restaurant run by a woman whose Thai nickname is Ord, who's been making boat noodles and other kinds of noodles in Thailand for, you know, decades, I think.
What kind of broth are we going to find in these noodles?
You usually have the choice of a beef broth or a pork broth. But whichever you have, there's going to be spices, probably three or four different kinds of chili, you know, dried and pickled and powdered and fresh, and whatever kind of devastation you feel like laying onto your oral cavity. And there's going to be some ground blood, which I think is mostly pork blood, which is going to give the soup some body. It's going to give it a dark, almost chocolate brown color, and which gives it sort of this wonderful, funky immediacy that's just you don't find anywhere else.
How does the broth for boat noodles differ from the broth for pho, for example?
Pho is a very delicate, long-cooked thing, you know, with spices in it. Typically, it could cook all day or a couple days if you wanted to. It's a very limpid, almost French-influenced bouillon. There ain't nothing delicate about boat noodle broth.
So it's like a giant firecracker going off in your mouth.
Yes, it is. It is the firecracker of noodles broths.
So if we're talking about the noodles themselves, what kind of noodles can we expect? Thick, thin, egg, no egg, dry, fresh?
At Pa Ord, the answer to that question is yes.
I had a feeling it might be.
they actually have a display of dried noodles up, and you can pick whether you want the wide rice noodles or you want the narrow rice noodles or the sort of in-between rice noodles. Or I actually like the egg noodles the best, like thin, eggy vermicelli, which have a nice bouncy texture in the broth.
And then they can absorb more broth and you could have more fire in every bite.
Exactly. And there's, of course, chili on the table in case the chili that they give you in the kitchen isn't sufficient.
And then what other options do you have? What else can you put in the soup?
They will generally bring you everything unless you specify. But for boat noodle beginners, you might want to specify whether you want tripe and or liver in the soup. I've got to say it. I mean, I admit that I always get it with the tripe but without the liver because the taste of boiled liver is pretty strong for me, and I have to be in a very specific boiled liver mood, which doesn't come across me that often.
And what else is there? Do you get to put in like a lot of raw spring onions or?
They'll throw in some scallions. They'll throw in, as I said, as many chilies as you want. You can ask for it mild or you can ask for it spicy. You can ask for it, my friend Carl does, pet, which means that you're going to get something that's you're going to feel for days afterwards.
Now, mild, is it really mild or is it just mild in comparison?
My daughter Isabel, who is like the princess in the pea when it comes to chilies, refuses to eat the broth in any of its permutations. So it's not that mild, but it's mild enough so that if you're the kind of person who eats Thai food, it's not going to bother you. Their object at Pa Ord is not to kill you. It's to make you return and return for delicious noodles.
So when you see the boat noodles on the menu, does the menu have a lot of variations that you can order, or is it just boat noodles and you're supposed to intuit all these variations?
It's just boat noodles. It's number two on the menu. You say boat noodles or the Thai name, which I so can't even come close to pronouncing. I'm not even going to try. They'll ask you a few questions, and there are your noodles. There's usually, you know, a couple fish balls in them, which are not extraordinary fish balls. You know, I've seen people with hand trucks delivering many cases of pre-manufactured fish balls into the restaurant, so I know that there isn't somebody lovingly molding them in the back. The woman who owns the place, Ord of Pa Ord, is almost always there, usually wearing, as are many of her waitresses, a polo shirt with a number on the back. There's big, like, photo mural of her in the restaurant selling noodles from an actual boat wearing the same shirt, so you figure that.
I love that. The shirt has seen a lot of miles.
It has.
Now, if you eat a bowl of boat noodles, does that mean that's it? That's what you're eating? Or can you venture forth and try other things on the menu?
You can try other things on the menu. They have two sizes of most of their noodle dishes, which is nice. You can either get, you know, the regular honkin' size or you can get a small size. That means if you want to taste the boat noodles and you want to taste the hot and sour noodles, you can do that. If you want to have some of their stir fries, which are not bad for side dishes in a noodle shop, then that's good too. There's a dish that's probably the best known of Chinese broccoli fried with, you know, crisp fried belly pork.
I love that dish. Okay, so tell us where we're having this delicious bowl of boat noodles. Give us the address.
We are at Pa Ord, and the address is 5301 Sunset in Hollywood.
All of Jonathan Gold's restaurant suggestions are on the Good Food Restaurant map. Find it at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can also hear me and Jonathan every Friday at 4:44 p.m. during All Things Considered right here on KCRW. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke to blogger Rob Eshman about what he thinks is wrong with LA's food scene. Some people agreed with Rob, saying that a lack of good public transit and poor zoning is to blame for a lackluster food culture. Others said that finding good food in LA is like a, quote, needle in the haystack, unquote. On the other hand, one listener loves the chaos of LA and suggests that improving it would be caving into European ideals. Check out all the comments at kcrw.com/goodfood. On Monday, the Lakers will play the Phoenix Suns in the Western Conference Finals. I've got some ideas for where you can watch the game. A roundup of sports bars is next. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be right back. Sports and bars. They're just made for each other. That's why there are things called sports bars. Jeff Miller, the LA editor of Thrillist, is with me this morning to point out a few that we have in our fair town. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how's it going, Evan?
Good.
Good.
So why don't you define what tips a bar over the edge to become an official sports bar for me?
To me, it's a place that is defined by the fact that you can see sports from anywhere you're at in the bar. So the emphasis is on watching the game, drinking during the game, and kind of enjoying sports while you're at the bar rather than enjoying the bar and having sports kind of be part of the background.
Are there a lot of them here in LA?
It's funny, there are a lot of them here in LA, but it's not a sports bar town, you know? I feel like a lot of people think that LA is kind of like negatory on the sports. And, you know, a lot of people do choose to watch sports at home on their TVs. But there are a lot of sports bars in LA. There's a lot of standby sports bars, I feel like.
What does that mean, standby?
Places that have been around for a while, certain neighborhood spots that people go to all the time. I mean, I put up on Facebook, you know, what are your favorite sports bars in LA? Just seeing what people said. And like Ye Olde Rustic Inn in kind of the Silver Lake area came up. And to me, that's not, I wouldn't think of that as a sports bar, but more than one person said, you know, when there's a big game, that's where I go. I feel like places like the Shortstop and Big Wang's, you know, these are places that have been around now for a while that a lot of people know about and go to watch their teams.
Now, do they tend to be congregated in one particular area or are they all over town?
They're all over town. I mean, there's certainly a big contingent in the Valley. There's this new contingent, a couple of the places that have just opened up on Cahuenga, which is kind of becoming a sports bar haven, which is really weird.
Yeah, it is really strange.
Yeah.
I was going to the farmer's market and I was walking up Cahuenga and I was like, wait, where am I? Am I in Westwood?
Well, and what's funny is that Westwood is a place where I barely even think of sports bars anymore. You know, I feel like classically that was a sports-centric spot in L.A., and now I'd be hard-pressed to come up with a great sports bar in Westwood.
Are the new sports bars that are coming online now also really good brew pubs?
Actually, there's kind of a difference. I feel like there's great beer bars that have just opened up and great sports bars that have just opened up, and there's a couple that kind of toe the line, but for the most part, the sports bars and the beer bars are kind of operating on separate levels. You know, the beer bars are for the people who are so into their beers, and the sports bars are for people who are so into their sports.
Wow, it seems like they should marry and have children.
You would think. Well, it's funny that the first place I wanted to talk about is kind of the one that's married and had children. It's called Essex, and it's one of the ones that's in Hollywood. It's on Hollywood Boulevard, and they do have great beers. I mean, that's a it's a spot that's like really connected with kind of the beer thing. They have Shinerbach and Old Rasputin and that kind of stuff. So it is kind of mixing the two, a sports bar and a beer bar.
So I find it really interesting that in this day and age when you can get so many really great beers, that there would be sports bars where they still want to just push a lot of Heineken.
Right, right. It's
so tell me what one of those might be.
One of the ones that would just want to push Heineken on you?
Yeah, you know.
Well, you know, there's this place that just opened called Goal that's kind of a...
Spell that.
It's a G-O-A-L, like you scored a goal. And
yeah.
Their beer list is not all that impressive. It's a fairly small beer list, and it's a fairly small bar. There's 13 screens, and it really does feel like you're covered by screens. A friend of mine yesterday was describing it as a boutique sports bar, which I really liked. I thought that was pretty funny.
And where is that?
That's on 3rd Street. It's in between the Grove and La Cienega on 3rd. And their kind of specialty is they have a burger that's stuffed with jack cheese that's like big and gooey to enjoy while you're watching the game.
And do all of these sports bars have food that's notable, or for most is food an afterthought?
I think that there's become this trend to actually pay attention to the menu at the different sports bars. I mean, I think especially the newer places that have opened up kind of understand that not everybody wants chicken wings, fries, and a burger. There's places that have salads. There's this place, it's called South in Santa Monica, and the owners are Southern, and everything on the menu is Southern specialties. They have, you know, fried pickles and okra and...
Oh, my God.
And, you know...
I have to go there one night when there's no game.
Well, and that's kind of like a more, I guess you'd say, like, fratty in a way. I don't know if they'd want me to say that, but, you know, it's a kind of a college-y type of bar in a really good way, because they have, like, trivia nights and karaoke nights, and then they also have, you know, big game nights.
If a person is a diehard, like let's say you're a diehard Lakers fan, mm-hmm. and you're following the games right now, mm-hmm. where are some good places to go?
I think one of the best places that's just recently opened in L.A. is called Capital City, and that's one of the ones on Cahuenga. It is enormous. It's 7,000 square feet. They have a movie screen-sized screen that literally you can see from across the street on Cahuenga. And their menu is also pretty good. They have like things like street tacos with chopped steak and onions and cilantro. They have mini lamb chops. So it's the kind of place where you can go. There's like private rooms. There's like 48 screens. I mean, it's like one of those places, like if you're talking about a communal experience, that's the place to go.
Are there any sports bars which specialize in following like a particularly arcane sport?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, I certainly know about some that show soccer. Not an arcane sport. Are you talking about like badminton?
Yeah.
or
curling.
I wish I could tell you about a curling bar in LA. In fact, that sounds like the kind of place that I would want to go just to people watch at.
Exactly.
And if any of the listeners that are listening know of one, I would love to hear about it, because I would love to know about a curling bar in LA.
Do sports bars that particularly follow soccer differ from the sports bars that follow, you know, football, baseball, basketball?
I think you definitely get a more international contingent at those bars. The one I'm thinking of off the top of my head is King's Head in Santa Monica. It's a British pub and it's European, and a lot of kind of the expat Europeans go there, and they'll show games at like, you know, 6 o'clock on like a Tuesday, and the place will be packed, especially during the World Cup. And there's certainly other places, you know, if you go to, you know, specific spots in the city that have big immigrant populations, you can basically find a sports bar that you may not even consider a sports bar just by looking at the line of people at 7 a.m. on a, you know, on a World Cup day or on the day of a big match.
Wow, that's really funny. 7 a.m. Everybody called in sick.
And then they were all from Italy. I don't understand what's happening. It's shocking.
A list of the sports bars Jeff talked about is at kcrw.com/goodfood. I wonder if there's a sports bar here in LA where I can watch footy. That's Australian rules football. Good Food producer Harriet Ells and I were invited to Australia, where we attended our first footy game. It was the Collingwood Magpies versus the North Melbourne Kangaroos. The Pies, as Collingwood is known, were favored. The game is a mix of rugby, American football, and soccer. Of course, I was mostly interested in what people ate at the game.
Con the pies.
Enjoy the pies.
Go Collingwood.
Have you already eaten during this game?
Yeah, we've eaten.
What'd you have?
Pies.
Pies?
Chips.
KFC.
Is food an important part of the sports experience here?
Yeah, it is, except its prices are really expensive.
What's your favorite thing to eat when you're at the game?
We're part of the boys. The men go and get food for us, and they come back with pies with sauce and hot dogs and chips, so we have to eat that.
It's good when you don't have a decision to make, right?
That's right, that's all right.
What do you eat when you come to the game?
Pies, sausage rolls, chips covered in sauce. It's generally the day.
So we're at the break of the game, and Collingwood's up by at least one, may have been more, since we walked from our seats. What kind of pies do they have?
We've only got meat pies.
What's the sauce?
It's the same as ketchup.
Can I have four pies, please? Oh, they're little. They're nice little ones. And they're called 4 and 20.
I'm going to put four in.
Okay, so you've just taken a really big bite. So you just go for the gusto and you eat all the way through?
A lot of people do the, if they've got a spoon, they'll peel the top off and then eat the meat and gravy out. And then the soggy pastry they'll take separately. But I find just to eat across, just to zigzag your way across is the best way.
Okay, I think it's time to take a bite. Let's go for it. That's really good. That's mighty tasty. That's a big portion, too. That's very delicious. We're going back to the game now. We need to eat and watch. A picture of the meat pies served at the footy game or at kcrw.com/goodfood. Incidentally, Collingwood won the game. You can see pictures and videos from our trip down under. They're on the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. And you can watch the videos on our app for the iPhone or iPod Touch. It's available on iTunes for just 99 cents. Pairing wine with cheese is a no-brainer. And our friends, the Hot Knives, have shown us that beer and cheese can be a formidable duo. But sake and cheese? This is a new combo that sounds like it will result in hours of grazing pleasure. Barry Lynn calls herself the cheese impresario.
I call it umami to the max. The bigger the umami, the savory flavor, the more amazing the pairings. So that's sort of what happened. And I really was tasting different cheeses and tasting the sakes. Like today I have the Hook's 10-year cheddar, and you've had Tony Hook on your show before. And his 10-year cheddar, they're out of Mineral Point, Wisconsin, you know, the cheddar capital. Every bite would send me to the further outer space.
Now, did you find that particular cheeses paired well with particular styles of sake? Like when you were tasting this Hook 10-year cheddar, which is really an exceptionally delicious cheese, what flavor profile really made it sing in terms of the sake?
Well, it really worked with different fruity sakes, more fruit forward, actually one quite dry one. And then I did pair it, which is a sake I would have never even had because I've had such bad experiences with plum wines, trying a plum wine. This is a plum sake, and it's called Juiced. It's kind of lightly orange, and our beautiful Hook's 10-year cheddar is kind of orange. And it is either before a meal, heavenly, or as a dessert.
Now, is this sake sweet, or is it just has a beautiful fruit but a dry finish?
It's got a it's definitely has the fruit because it's 21% fruit, but it's also got that kind of sweet dry. I would guess I'd call it in between. It's not like putting honey on a beautiful artisanal cheese. It does something different because of the alcohol and the style of this particular brewmaster.
Now, you have a very attractively arranged plate of cheeses in front of us here, and there's one in particular that is a very soft, looks to be very creamy cheese.
Well, my mother sort of gave me post-traumatic stress disorder because she liked Cheese Whiz. And anything cheese spready made me go crazy, just really run away. And I took myself on a trip to Wisconsin because I was really curious what was going on there, and I was studying, really traveling all over. And I went to visit third-generation Wisconsin master cheesemaker Joe Widmer in his beautiful plant in the middle of the green rolling hills. And he pulled out his aged cheddar. Oh, delicious. Then he pulled out the aged brick spread. I wanted to run, but I couldn't do it. I really had to be polite and say, oh, thank you, I would love some. You know, I mean, he was so proud of what he had, and I just couldn't let my history with my mom get in the way. So I tasted this, and I just went mad. It's so delicious, so robust, but soft and creamy, very sensual.
And so what kind of sake did you feel really set this one off?
Well, I used a medium sake called Euphoria. And I love that name because it really is that kind of sensual feeling and euphoric feeling when you put these together. And Euphoria is a medium fruity sake done by famous brewmaster Sato.
Now, there's another cheese you have here that, judging from the rind, could it be a smoked cheese?
Yes, very lightly smoked. This is also by a Wisconsin master cheesemaker, Sid Cook, who is the most awarded cheesemaker on the planet. I hope he can come and visit someday. He's traveling all over, so I hope. And he's so creative with cheese, Evan, that some people call him the Jimi Hendrix of cheese because he does things that nobody else does. This is a goat, cow, and sheep cheese in a proprietary blend, cold smoked over hickory. And I love this with Banzai's Best in the East. This has a little bit more fruity flavor profile with a very long finish, just like this cheese. And when I would take a bite of the cheese and then take a sip of the sake, I found that at first you go, oh, that's really good. And then you take another bite and another sip and you go, whoa, that is really good. By the third one, you are, again, really traveling a cheese highway that you wish you could travel over and over again, because the flavors just come together and they really dance. They like open up like a flower in slow motion. When you see that happening, I felt that pairing, that's what happened to me. The cheese opened, the sake opened, and they kept flying and flying together.
Thank you so much, Barry.
You're welcome, Evan. Thank you for having me on.
I've got some sake and cheese pairing ideas at kcrw.com/goodfood. Go ahead and download some past episodes of Good Food and subscribe to the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find pictures, recipes, and info on all of our guests there, too. Spend some time with your food friends on Facebook and follow my fan page there. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced and edited by the fabulous Harriet Ells, along with Bob Carlson, Jillian Ferguson, and Candace Moyer. Thanks to Gary Messiha. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.